I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Barbara Jenkins takes over as Orange County's new school superintendent. At the same time, the FCAT is facing a credibility crisis. A lot is at stake. The Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test determines school funding, the courses students take, and whether or not students progress to the next grade or even graduate. Nearly 2 million students statewide take the test, but in the wake of shockingly low writing scores, many are asking, is the FCAT a reliable measure of student achievement? Does the test detract from learning? This week, I'll talk with Jenkins about the FCAT and other challenges facing Orange County schools. That's ahead on Intersection. Barbara Jenkins is Orange County School's new superintendent. She takes over the nation's 10th largest school system just as criticism has exploded over the FCAT, the state standardized exam, which determines whether students graduate and how much funding schools can get. Jenkins faces a lot of other challenges, though. Those include low funding, teacher morale also among them. But she does have local roots, a Winter Park High School graduate, and started her career as an Orange County teacher. Barbara Jenkins, great to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here, Mark. Thank you.
So everyone, of course, is talking about these FCAT scores that came out just a few weeks back. Incredibly low scores, which prompted state educators to hold an emergency meeting, adjust the passing grade on those FCATs so that school funding not drastically affected. Of course, this has sparked a wide debate, criticism that the FCAT grades are arbitrary, meaningless, too much testing, detracting from education. Orange County's outgoing superintendent Ron Blocker says the system that he once supported has changed into something else, morphed into something else, and that these shockingly low scores might be one of those watershed moments. What are your thoughts on this latest information and news coming out about the FCAT?
And what you're referring to, Mark, are actually the writing scores, where there was a tremendous outcry over the changing in the scoring of the writing essays, where our students are asked to write a draft essay, and then it is scored by some professionals. And what happened over a period of time, last July, school districts were put on notice that there would be some increased scrutiny by the scores around certain issues such as level of detail, and grammatical constructs. And so while there was some communication, the belief is, although it will be up to the state to do their final determination, that the what was conveyed to school districts and what was conveyed to those who scored the writing may have been somewhat different. And so when the scores came out, they were much lower than projected. And the state board, I think very wisely, had the commissioner drop that cut score back for a passing score back to a 3 instead of a 4, which is almost like a hold harmless or a 1 year time to try to get straight whatever went wrong with the writing test for FCAT.
So what are your thoughts, though, on those actions and how it affected grades on the FCAT for Orange County?
What it did for Orange County and the rest of the state was sort of put us back at the starting point of where our scores were last year, by and large. I think that was wise on the part of the Board of Education at the state level. I always like for folks to understand it was not our local school board. It was the state Board of Education. I believe that was a wise intervention on their part, because clearly something went wrong in the communication to districts, 67 districts, and what was done by those who were paid to do the scoring of the test. So I think it was a wise intervention on the part of the state Board of Education until they can better construct what went wrong and then make sure there's a clear communication to all 67 districts around how the scoring is going to evolve for next year and give teachers a chance to really have a greater impact on what students expect and what's expected of them on those FCAT writing tests.
Is it a watershed moment? Is it changing the way you think about the FCAT?
You know, I have mixed feelings. I understand and fully support the notion that public education has to have some means of accountability. And by and large, the easiest means for accountability of school systems would be through standardized testing. I do not believe that is the only measure of the success that our students experience, however, and I would like to see a wider range of assessments or evaluations that prove how much students know. But in the interim, I tell folks quite frankly, standardized testing is not going to go away. There has to be some measure of accountability. And over the time period that FCAT has been in place, our students have shown measured growth in their performance. And so I support some means of accountability. I certainly support raising the bar so that our students perform at higher and higher levels every year and that they can compete nationally and internationally. All of those notions have my support. My concern is that we have clear communication from the state level to the district level, and so that our teachers are really prepared for what they're going to be scored on or assessed on. That's my greatest concern. And I think the state, when they dealt with additional cut scores and some other measures that they changed this year, may have just moved rather swiftly in comparison to what time there may have been needed to prepare our teachers and our students.
What are you hearing from Orange County teachers about this? And in particular, I'm curious if you've gotten any feedback as the FCAT relates to assessing teachers for merit pay and those sort of scores. Was this like a real wake-up call for teachers to say, wow, you know, I could be in some serious financial trouble even if these scores don't work out?
You know, our teachers are committed to their profession. We've not had a large outcry that was self-centered around what's going to happen to me and will this impact my score, because those kind of decisions really don't happen this year. It will take a couple of years to get those models in place, the pay-for-performance models. And so we've not heard that kind of outcry. I think the greater concern was, as a profession, we need for folks to clearly understand we are instructing our students and doing it well. And there was more of a concern, Mark, that students and parents not be overly alarmed that all of a sudden a child who had a 5 last year, which is a very good score, ends up with a 3 this year, that parents would not be overly alarmed and that the blame would lie where it belongs, and that somehow the scoring and the instruction were not aligned and the communication could have been better.
In your position, in a leadership position for Orange County Schools, are you thinking about this particular class that's been affected by these grades? And in terms of the FCAT's overall goal of getting students ready for today's competitive global economy, getting them college ready, is there a concern, you know, following this particular class where this incident has happened all the way through their tenure in Orange County Schools, how that's going to affect them ultimately being ready for that next step after public schooling?
The writing test in and of itself is not my greatest concern. If you recall, all of the FCAT, the reading and the math scores as well, had increases in their cut scores. And so we're just really going through that information and seeing how it impacts our students. I'm pleased to say when we compare, if you place the same kind of cutoff scores on last year's measures, then Orange County pretty much held its own. In several instances, we showed growth for our students. And we outpaced the state in a couple of those areas as well. So I am pleased that our teachers and our students held their own in this transition year. And Mark, what I like to describe it as, and what I've heard others describe it as, is a market correction year. It is a renorming, almost resetting of the clock for us around our student achievement measures. But then most parents understand it, quite frankly, if we said we're marching down this football field and the goalposts were just picked up and moved a little bit further away. I don't mind that challenge. I don't mind the goalposts being moved. We're going to have to intensify our efforts to help our students be successful.
So you don't think there's a dark mark in the academic records that's going to follow students throughout
because
of this whole reset issue with the state, with the FCAT?
No, I don't. But I think it's confusing. If we look at reverted scores, meaning you change the guidelines for scoring last year and then compare that to this year, they look pretty good. We show some growth. I think the problem is on a marketing side that you've got to make sure parents and the community are not alarmed if their school goes from an A to a B simply because of those scores, simply because of the goalposts being moved. And so we've made a concerted effort to try to get that word out through our schools, through our PTAs, through various civic organizations and through the media, that people understand the goalposts have been moved doesn't mean that the learning has dropped off dramatically. And so statewide, if you see a huge change, they've tried to convey that same message as well so that it doesn't have a negative impact on these students and certainly on our economy.
You know, you've got so many groups who are all working on this same broad team of education, but there's certainly different factions, different organizations that are all part of this overall conversation. You've got the State Board of Education, you've got the Teachers Union, you've got the State School Superintendents Association as well. Is everybody in lockstep on this, or is the State Superintendents Association planning stuff as we speak to get ready for a legislative session, which, you know, will be here before you know it?
So, Mark, you would need to talk to Ron Block, who's the current president of the State Superintendents Association.
I didn't know if you might have heard anything. I'm just
curious. You know, I've not been in their meetings yet. I'm a newbie. I will attend the meeting next week in Tampa, but in the meantime, I've not been officially a part. I've listened in on some conference calls, and certainly they have some opinions and some strategies, but they will need to crystallize those and move forward and make their own announcement.
But do you think, though, are people generally in lockstep on these issues, or do you see a wide disparity?
No, I think there's a general agreement that high standards are appropriate for our students, that high standards are good for public education. I think there's also a general agreement with those outside of the State Board of Education that the pacing of significant changes that took place recently may have been a little bit swift and may have gotten ahead of our teachers and instruction, which wasn't exactly appropriate for students, that those outcomes would change. But outside of those two entities, we probably diverge on some of our opinions about what should happen next. But I don't think you get any disagreement that high standards are appropriate. I don't think you get any disagreement from those of us outside of the State Board of Education that the pacing may have been a little bit strenuous for our school system. But I believe we can recover, and I believe we can move forward from here. We're very positive, and my conversations with our teachers have been around, here are the ways we're going to help support you so that you can be successful in the system and in the requirements that are set before you.
You know, a lot of what you're saying does sound very similar to messages we hear coming out of Tallahassee and at multiple levels. And I just wonder, what do you think is the role of that rhetoric? Is it just rhetoric that we hear when everyone comes together and say, you know, we do want all these positive outcomes. We do think standardized testing is here to stay and that it needs to be a part of the system. But at what point do you divide your actual philosophy on it? And at what point do you think the rhetoric maybe takes over more than it should?
I want to be clear. I was not implying that Tallahassee is lockstep with what you would hear in the local community. I was trying to convey what would happen outside of Tallahassee. While there's still some agreement with local levels and with the state legislature, I'm sorry, the State Board of Education as well, here is where there will be a divide. I think you will have factions around the notion of, is standardized testing good for our children? There is a growing swell among parents and a grassroots effort that says, you know, we've really had enough. This really is not what we want for our children. It's not what's best for students around standardized testing. I think you have a division there where some perhaps teachers, some parents, some civic organizations, or some politicians may be saying it's too much. There's time that we all just stand up to the state and try to put an end to it. And then there are those who would say that's probably not going to be a successful battle with Race to the Top, with any reauthorization of our ESEA law. There will probably be continued requirement for some means of standardized testing in order to compare how students have evolved and how they're learning. I think the state's plan to go toward 2015 or thereabout to a different kind of assessment that's not bubbling in answers, but a much more vast assessment called the PARC, that will help us compare state to state and also give students a chance to take on a problem-solving format rather than bubbling in the right answer in years to come, I think will help evolve and settle some of those issues, because standardized testing as it stands today really doesn't get at all of the brilliance that we have in our students and their ability to be creative thinkers and innovators and problem solvers.
You're a Winter Park High School graduate. Do you think it is...
Go Wildcats.
Do you think is the system better than it was when you went to school?
I have to say public education in general is better than it was. It has evolved and it has grown because we want our students to 21st century learners have got to do something different than what we had to do when I was in high school, which I don't have to mention what year I graduated. Well, it was 1979, and if you can look in the paper, I'm 51 years old. You could figure that out. the time that I was in school, what was required of students and expected of employees that were coming out of the school system was vastly different. And we know that 21st century learners are going to have different skill sets, need different skill sets than those who graduated back when I was in school. For instance, they have got to be creative thinkers. They've got to be innovative. They've got to be adept at working in groups and solving problems. That's what employers are looking for. And Mark, the truth is, some of the jobs that they will have in the future, students that are in our public school system currently, don't even exist now. But the skill set for 21st century learners, pretty consistently, we know from employers and from research, will be around creative thinking, innovation, problem solving, communication skills, working with teams and with groups. And we've got to make sure our students are prepared for those kinds of skills, as well as what is currently measured in FCAT or in other standardized tests.
Let me just get one more question about FCAT. You know, some students who score poorly on the test have to take remediation classes instead of electives. And I just wonder, how do you think this affects classes like the arts or music or those other areas of social progress for the academic field?
Certainly it limits their enrollment, because if I'm in a high school where I've got several students that need to take remedial reading, I can't afford, my dollars won't support extensive electives as well as several remedial reading teachers and classes. And so I'm going to have an impact on the fine arts in my school if I have large numbers of students that need to be remediated. We do have some additional resources. If a school has a high enough poverty level, then they get some additional Title I funds that will help offset that imbalance. But I think for those students who need the remedial classes, it is critical that we still give them exposure to the arts. That will be motivation for some of our students to keep coming to school. We cannot just remediate them and not have them excited about their education and about their future. And some of their gifts and talents will be in the fine arts as well. And so we have efforts in place with after-school tutoring, with an additional period with extended learning time that can help get at the remedial needs and still have those students get some exposure to electives and the arts.
Do you think that teachers of fine arts feel like they're more exposed in this whole standardized test FCAT world?
You know, it's probably an uneasy period for our fine arts teachers for a couple of reasons. As we move down the road toward what will be required EOC exams for every subject area, it will be uncomfortable for the fine arts and the elective teachers as well. And I think over the past several years statewide, those jobs for the fine arts have been harder and harder to come by. And quite often they fall prey to budget cuts because you can't cut your remedial reading classes. You've got to have those. Now, fortunately, our community here in Central Florida has been so generous, so kind to us. We passed an additional mill. Commitment of our school board and our school leadership was that we would maintain our level of service and not see any regression in what we offer in the fine arts in our schools. So that additional funding for the mill actually saved us from some very difficult decisions that other districts have to deal with.
Fascinating conversation with Barbara Jenkins, incoming Orange County Schools Superintendent. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. What is most important to you when it comes to schools? Tell us about it on Facebook or find us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Send us an email if you want to intersection@WMFE.org. And let me put that question to you, Barbara Jenkins. What is most important to you when it comes to schools?
I am very passionate about what public education and a good education can mean for all of our students. We serve over 180,000 students. People are just in shock when they realize how many students we actually serve. And Mark, that spectrum of the students that we serve goes from the very talented, the brilliant intellectually, to those that have the most extreme handicaps that we serve as well, either physical or intellectual handicaps that we serve. And they go from the very affluent to the very poor, and over 4,000 homeless students. And by the way, that's twice the number of homeless students that we had last year. So the economy really is having an impact on our families. 15% of our students come to us not speaking English. Our ELL population is at 15%. And 13% of our students are in exceptionalities. Another number that really staggers folks is that we serve, those students come in speaking over 160 languages and dialects from 200 countries. The staggering thing around the economical side is that our free and reduced lunch level is up to 64%. We're between 64 and 66% with the latest information that we've gathered. That means by federal poverty levels and guidelines, that number of our students qualify to either have a reduced price for their lunches or a free lunch, and that is up significantly as well. I think the wonderful thing about urban education, that beautiful spectrum that we serve, is that some of our poorest students may also be our most brilliant. And affluence doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have some handicaps that need to be served. And so the challenge before us in an urban setting, and the challenge that we are excited about, we celebrate our diversity, never use it for an excuse, but we work hard to make sure every one of those students can experience success. And so there are a couple of focuses that you will see this coming year. And Ron Blocker has built a tremendous foundation. He took our graduation rate from under 50% to 80%, 91% if you only count our traditional high schools. That is phenomenal in the time period that he's been superintendent. So on that foundation and the other continual growth measures that we've seen, we're going to have a couple of focuses. And the first and foremost should be no surprise. It's around student achievement. And because we are measured through standardized testing, we're going to continue to try to push those scores higher because it's an example, ready evidence to the quality job that our teachers are getting done in the classrooms. And so you're going to see us still push for those numbers to go higher and try to increase our momentum around our student achievement. I believe if you have a robust curriculum, that if you have quality teaching going on every day in every classroom and you have support for every teacher, then you will see that take place. And that robust curriculum will cover FCAT requirements and more, because we don't want our students to only get exposure to what FCAT is going to test them for. Secondly, we've got to work very hard for our students in various subgroups so that we have improvement on our gaps. We don't want to see that students on free and reduced lunch have significant or growing gaps. Different minority populations or ELL, those that don't speak English, populations having growing gaps. We want to see those gaps improving. So we've got to intensify our efforts around achievement gaps. Now, the way we get there is to show significant support and provide significant support for our teachers. So we're going to put in a new instructional management system that was piloted in the spring. Teachers that have been exposed to it are extremely excited, because it's going to put at the fingertips of every teacher in every classroom some abilities that they've not had in the past. And this is through our Race to the Top funding that we were able to purchase such a system. It's going to help them have drill around ability on all of their student data, all of that information that they need to be privy to that they've used paper and pencil for in the past to try to keep on top of where students were and what their needs were. They're going to have it on their computer right at their desk. They're going to have significant exposure and the ability to draw on gold standard lesson plans, on the curriculum information. They won't have to gather all on their own. They'll have a lot of resources right at their fingertips.
Are you concerned? Of course, these tools are fascinating when you see them come out, and certainly the data you can get and the way you can use the computer is such an amazing instrument in the classroom. But are you ever concerned that we shift too much emphasis on computers and lose sight of that personal connection that really can spark a student's interest in the classroom? And you can't always teach that.
Sure. I'd love to speak to that, Mark. I think, and let me be clear, what I was referring to is a teacher tool that the teacher can use in their planning time. I'm excited about that. It will save them time. It will give them resources. Every teacher that's been exposed to it has just been overjoyed, like finally we're going to have some assistance and not have to do it all by hand. When it comes to the classroom, though, it is not a given that increasing technology in a classroom drives student achievement higher. That is not the case. You can have all kinds of toys and gadgets, and the students can be giddy over the gadgets. If I don't have quality instruction going on and a connection with those students to help them to learn and to grow, then the technology will not have any kind of impact.
Does that affect your view on projects then, like the Florida Virtual School, which is online and through video?
Not at all, because here's what we're dealing with, Mark. We have a generation of digital natives who are adept at technology, and we cannot have them approach the schoolroom, the classroom door, and power down all of their exposure to technology. Even our students that come from some of our neediest neighborhoods, if they have a smartphone, they've got access to the internet. And so we need for our classroom to be engaging and interactive, including some technology that will motivate and captivate our students, because that's the world they live in. They will not just sit still for a teacher standing at the front of the room with a chalkboard. We don't even have chalkboards anymore. But they will not engage and learn as much if we don't have an exciting and an engaging curriculum with some tools, and certainly the technology that they're accustomed to will help engage them as well. It just needs to be used appropriately.
I like that. I must be an analog expat or some sort of digital alien.
You are a digital immigrant, as I am.
Okay.
Immigrants have to come. They still have to read the book on how to operate a piece of technology. The natives just figure it out on their own.
You know, you're facing, of course, budget constraints, as are all school districts. And, of course, Orange County voters approved a property tax 2 years back, sparing the district from some of the financial problems that places like Seminole County are seeing. And I wonder, what do you see going ahead for financial challenges? You just laid out all these services that you're trying to reach to a diverse student population. What's top on the budget concern for you?
I feel very fortunate that this community did approve that additional mill for schools. Our school board worked very hard in the community to sell that, to make sure folks understood the need. And our community stepped up and they provided what we had need of. And so commendations are certainly due to our administrative team and our school board especially, who took on the leadership to get that done. And a huge thanks is due every time we have the opportunity, Mark. We will thank our community for that vote of confidence and for providing those funds. Because what that means, in essence, is about an $83 million shortfall we do not have to deal with. If it hadn't been for that on an annual basis, we would be looking, like several other counties, at making some significant budget cuts. And I tell you, in a district that is largely run by people, you can't get to those kind of dollars without having some layoffs and impacting what you're able to offer, the level of service you're able to offer to your students. And so our county is extremely fortunate, and our board is very thankful to this community for those resources. Now, that does not mean, and I want to stress, doesn't mean we're able to restore things that happened from past budget cuts. It helped stop any additional cutting. We're able to maintain our level of service. And the understanding we have at the central office and that I expect of my chiefs is that we continue to look for efficiencies and means of saving dollars so that we can reinvest them in matters that impact our classroom and impact our students.
You know, you mentioned a couple of years ago, there was a big issue about perhaps having to close small neighborhood schools, elementary schools. Do you think something like that could come back up?
We would be looking at several different painful budget cuts if it weren't for the provision set before us. I recall we were looking at athletics, we were looking at fine arts, we were looking at small schools. All of those things had to be under consideration because the deficit was significant. And if the federal government hadn't stepped in, we would have had to suffer through some of those cuts. Instead, we had a bridge that carried us over, and then the mill was added in once the federal dollars began to drain away. And so we're able not to suffer those areas. Doesn't mean that we may not have to consider certain issues that are painful in the future, but we are very pleased for the next couple of years not to have extreme budget shortfalls.
Of course, your predecessor, Ron Blocker, worked largely on the desegregation lawsuit that Orange County Schools had been under. Can you update us on that? Is everything taken care of, or where do we stand?
We are unitary, which means that the vestiges of a segregated school system are no more. But we also have a committee that sort of helps us monitor to make sure we don't slip back into some of those practices. And I don't want to say practices as though there was anything intentional or discriminatory that was going on. But we've got a committee that will sort of keep tabs and sort of watch to make sure, as an assistance to us, to make sure we're on top of those areas as well. And so we're pleased to be unitary, and we will continue to work to make sure every child gets a quality education.
Barbara Jenkins, a lot more issues to talk about, but I'm afraid we're just out of time. So I just want to say it's been wonderful to speak with you, Barbara Jenkins, the new Orange County School Superintendent. I hope to have you back soon, and we can talk about more stuff.
Thank you, Mark.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Tell us what you think the biggest challenges are facing Florida schools on Facebook or Twitter. Find us at WMFE Orlando. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson. Thanks for listening.